Who liketh to hear that he is a tool? Said he, with a certain effort. And particularly who would hear it from a brat like thee? Coming from thee, young slave Usarsif, it is shameless. But on the other hand, that is just what I say, that it cometh to the same thing, and even so it might be the Ishmaelites who are coming with thee, and it is really thou to whom I must open the way. It is all one. Moreover, I had a well to watch down there, to say nothing of the ass.
A well?
I always had to reckon with such a job, as far as the well was concerned. It was the emptiest hole I ever saw. Could not be emptier. And the more absurd was its emptiness, by that measure may be judged the dignity and fitness of my task. Yet perhaps it was the very emptiness that was the important thing about this well.
Was the stone rolled away?
Of course, I sat on it, and I remained sitting however much the man wanted me to go.
What man?
Why, he who in his folly came secretly to the well, a man of towering stature, with legs like the pillars of a temple, and inside this husk a poor thin voice.
Reuben!
Cried Joseph, almost forgetful of caution. Call him as thou wilt, it was a blundering tower of a man. Came back there with his rope and his coat to such a proper empty hole.
He wanted to save me, Joseph affirmed.
As thou wilt, said the guide, and yawned like a woman, putting his hand affectedly before his mouth and giving a dainty little sigh. He too played his role, he added. His voice was indistinct, for he had tucked his chin and mouth farther into his mantle and seemed to want to go to sleep. Joseph heard him, still muttering disconnectedly and irritably, "Trifling and folly. Words of a young brat." There was nothing more pertinent to be got out of him. Even in their further journey, Joseph did not succeed in getting more speech with his guard and guide. The Fort of Thel. Day by day they plodded patiently through the Badlands, to the sound of the bell on the leading camel, from well station to well station, until 9 days had passed, and they counted themselves lucky. The guide had not boasted when he said he knew his business. He did not lose his way nor get off the road, even when it passed through wild mountain country where there was no good going, but merely a confusion of frightful sandstone boulders, grotesque shapes, and towering masses that glistened blackly, more like bronze than stone. Their somber gleam suggested a tall city built of iron. The guide held on his road all day long, even when there could be no talk of a road in any upper-worldly sense at all, for it was like a country of the damned, like the illimitable floor of the sea, shutting them in, with corpse-colored sand, up to the hot, bleached horizon. And they rode over mounds of dune, with ridges ruffled by the wind into unpleasant, sharp-edged patterns. Across the plain, the heat vibrations looked as though near to bursting into tongues of flame, and sand whirled in the air so that the men wrapped their heads before this evil dance of death and tried not to look, but rode blindly on to get past these horrors. Bleached skeletons often lay by the way, the ribs and thigh bones of a camel and the parched limbs of a human being stood up out of the waxen-colored dust. They looked at it dazed and kept on trying to hope. 2 half-days long, from midday to evening, a pillar of fire went on before and seemed to guide them. They well knew the nature of the phenomenon, but their attitude toward it was not conditioned by their knowledge. These fiery pillars were, as they were aware, small cyclones, in which the whirling dust was turned flame-colored by the sun. But to each other they said with due awe, "A pillar of fire leadeth us on." If the sign were suddenly to collapse before their eyes, it would be frightful, for in all probability a dust abubu would follow. But the pillar did not collapse, only changed its shape like a genie, and slowly flickered away on the northeast wind, which prevailed throughout the 9 days. Their good luck banned the south wind, that it was quiet and could not parch their waterskins, and drink away the moisture on which their lives depended. But on the 9th day they were already out of danger, escaped from the horrors of the desert, and could count themselves fortunate, for the region now before them was colonized and administered by Egypt. Bastions, breastworks, and watchtowers by the wells extended for some distance into the desert, with little companies of soldiery, Nubian bowmen wearing ostrich feathers in their hair, and Libyan axe-bearers with Egyptian captains, who called out harshly to the oncomers and questioned them whence they came and whither they went. The old man had a shrewd and cheery way of talking with the military, to put beyond doubt the innocence of his designs, and of giving them little presents out of his pack—knives, lamps, and Ascalon onions—to win their goodwill. So they passed, well pleased, through all the formalities from watch to watch, for it was much better to be exchanging jokes with the guards than to be going through the brazen city and across the bleached sea-floor. Our travelers, however, knew that only the preliminaries were over with the passing of these frontier stations, and that they had still to prove their harmlessness and their innocence of any designs against civilized society. The real test would come at the mighty and ineluctable barrier which the old man called the Sovereign's Wall, which had been built ages before across the neck of land between the great and little Bitter Lakes as a protection against the savages of Shosu and the sand-dwellers who thought to drive their cattle upon Pharaoh's soil. From the rising ground, where they had halted at sunset, they overlooked these menacing precautions and arrogant measures of defense. The old man had succeeded several times, by dint of his harmless garrulity, in passing them in both directions, wherefore he did not now fear them all too much. Tranquilly he lifted his hand and pointed them out to his train. A long marching wall, notched with battlements, broken by towers and running behind canals which connected a chain of lakes great and small. Somewhere about the middle, a bridge crossed the water, but at this point, on either side of the passage, rose the sternest barriers of all. Castellated forts, enclosed in their own ring-walls, two-storied, massive, and tall, whose sides and ajutments rose in ingenious broken lines to the parapets to make them yet more secure against siege. They bristled with square battlemented towers, bastions, sally-ports, and ledges for defense on all sides. Narrower structures had grated windows. This was the fort of Thel, the powerful offensive and defensive structure set up by the refined and fortunate and vulnerable land of Egypt against the poverty and rapine of the East. The old man named it to his followers by name, and was not afraid before it. But yet he said so much about it, asserting how easy it would be for his utter harmlessness to get past once more, that one might have thought he was talking to keep his courage up. "Did I tell you I have a letter from a business friend at Gilead across the Jordan?" he said, "to his business friend at Jonet, also called Zoan, which was built 7 years after Hebron? Well, I have, and you will see. It will open for us gate and door. The great thing is to have a document to show, and that the people of Egypt have in their turn to write something and send it somewhere to be copied down again and keep the record. For without something written, you do not get through. But if you can show a potsherd or a roll and document, then they brighten up. They say, of course, that Amun is the highest, or Osiris the eye enthroned. But I know better. At bottom, it is Tot, the writer. Believe me, if only Horwaz comes on the wall, the young officer clerk who is an old friend of mine, and I can get speech with him, then there will be no trouble at all, and we can pass. Once we are inside, nobody tests our innocence again, and we can go freely through all the districts up the river as far as we like. Let us set up huts here and pass the night, for my friend Horwaz will not come on the wall any more today. But tomorrow, before we go thither and beg for entrance at the fort of Thel, we must wash ourselves and dust the desert from our garments and wipe it out of our ears and scratch it out from our nails, that we seem to them like men and not like sand-rabbits. Also you young ones must pour oil on your hair and paint your eyes and make yourselves look wanton, for to them misery is suspect, and lack of elegance,
an abomination.